deadly threatening did not really bother me. I had encountered much riskier moments as a bounty hunter. The drivers of these trucks were just bullies. I kept going, and eventually they peeled away. Still, I was annoyed enough to tell the Chatwins what had happened. And they explained that it was not really all that unusual. This was a standard greeting committee of souped-up trucks called plague rigs. The dark tinted windows made it impossible to identify the occupants, which helped strangers clearly understand they were unwanted by scaring the heck out of them. There is nothing like personal experience to help an investigator form a conclusion, and the scales tipped farther. There was no way to ignore this latest episode, because it had not happened to someone else. I had been the target. There was nothing subtle about it at all. I had to start thinking about the FLDS in an entirely different light. The Empire struck back a few weeks later. I was still in bed early on a Saturday morning when Ross called to let me know that church-assigned work crews were gathering outside his house. They intended to move his brother Stephen and Stephen's family into the upstairs portion of the home. Stephen was blindly loyal to the church and was assigned the task of harassing Ross into wanting to move. I grabbed a copy of Joan's letter and made it to Ross and Lori's place by 7:30 a.m. The scene looked like a convention of contractors. About 50 men were already on site, readying their tools and unloading building material from their pickup trucks. I parked and got out, determined to get them to back off. The problem was that these Short Creek workers were unfamiliar with concepts like due process of law, constitutional rights, liberty, independence, and being master of your own fate. These men simply did whatever the prophet commanded them to do. End of story. Consequently, the letter that I showed them, which would have been taken very seriously at any other job site in America, only served to puzzle these people. They paused to await further orders from church leaders. In Utah, even in Short Creek, people are generally polite, and the confused workers were in a quandary. They had been taught unwavering obedience from the cradle and to live their religion. They also knew that not following their leader's orders held dire consequences. Any of them could become the next Ross Chatwin if they did not follow their instructions exactly. I had presented them with an unexpected legal gauntlet that went directly against the word of the prophet. Their response was to call for help. The town marshals. Up drove Sam Roundy Jr., the town's chief marshal. A six-footer who weighs in at over 300 pounds and wears a badge and gun, but dresses just like any other FLDS member. His shirt stretched tight across his belly. He and a couple of deputies took charge. Now it was my turn to be puzzled. I immediately asked Roundy why he was there in the first place. This was a civil dispute, in which he had no authority other than to keep the peace and possibly arrest anyone who might try to break into the Chatwin home. Under state law, the police do not have the authority to become involved in civil disputes between private parties. To intervene would quite possibly violate the Chatwins' constitutional rights, which meant the cops would be the ones breaking the law. On the other hand, I was glad to see them arrive because at least they were sworn law enforcement officers. They could interpret the legalities for the workmen and settle the situation. I made some introductory private investigator to police officer small talk to put them at ease, then handed Roundy the letter from Dudley. Roundy was trapped. He didn't even pretend to be a real cop. The marshal pulled out his cell phone, hit the speed dial, and his first words were, "Uncle Warren?" He turned away from me and read the letter aloud over the phone. When he hung up, he deliberately threw the document to the ground. "This doesn't mean anything to me," he snapped, and turned to the men standing around. "You men get to work. Go on in," he told them. When Roundy ordered a deputy to break off the locks on the door, Ross handed over a key. The front door opened, and about 50 workmen jammed inside. It was a disturbing and unreal sight. In that other world, where the rest of America lives, police cannot just show up and send people into one's home without a warrant and have them literally tear the house apart. This was breaking and entering, vandalism, trespassing, and about a half dozen more criminal offenses. But worst of all, it was a violation of what most Americans consider to be their absolute constitutional right, to be secure in their persons, places, and things. It was a grotesque intrusion by a government agency into a U.S. citizen's home under the color of law. The first of many illegal actions by the Colorado City Town Marshal's Office that I would witness in the years to come. While I was protesting to Roundy, one of his brothers, who is also a deputy, told Ross to get into the police car. "Hey, he's arresting me," Ross called out. That quickly got my attention. I was outraged and barked, "Why are you arresting him? What has he done? You can talk to him, but you can't detain him. It's his home and property." Unable to cite any charges, they backed down and let him go. The officers had been ready to snatch a private citizen into custody simply because they wanted to. The entire morning had become a legal circus. From inside the house came the pounding of hammers and the whine of power saws. The carpenters were already busy. I pulled my video camera out and began recording the crime in progress. Racking my brain about how to stop the madness, I pointed out the absence of building permits. The contractors claimed that they were working off the original permit, which I knew was 5 years old and would have long expired. Another call was made, and within minutes, the building inspector, David Darger, was on the scene. He arrived with a fresh extension for the expired permit and a set of plans for the original house, claiming that the workers were just there to finish the job and bring it up to code. It seemed clear to me that no matter what legal obstacle I could come up with, they would simply take whatever steps were necessary to accomplish their orders. The inspector remained on site throughout the day and night, handing out any needed approvals and doing so-called inspections as the work rolled along, as well as chipping in to finish the job. He reclassified the structure as a duplex so the two halves could not be joined. The staircase that I had helped Ross build was condemned, and the inspector actually helped seal it up. By 2 o'clock the next morning, their work was done. The crew had covered up the new stairway with joists, laid out new flooring, installed plumbing, spread carpet and linoleum, drywalled and painted, and put in counters and countertops. Stephen Chatwin and his family moved in. I could only shake my head in disbelief. There was nothing left to do. The FLDS and its United Effort plan had ignored basic civil rights and built an apartment right before my eyes as the cops stood by to enforce the will of the church while ignoring the laws of the land. It would have been fruitless to call for help from another police agency. The nearest real cops were in the county seat of Kingman, Arizona, 5 hours away, and a request to try to get them to sort this out would probably have been shrugged off with some comment like, "It's Short Creek. What do you expect?" I was coming to understand that every official in town might be willing to blindly follow church leaders and that ignoring the truth was a normal practice of the FLDS hierarchy. It had been done that way for many decades in their parallel universe. I was furious, but I was also hungry, and I suggested to Ross that we go get some breakfast.
"Okay, we can go down to Hurricane."
"Why?" I asked. Hurricane was 21 miles down the road. "No restaurants here are going to serve you because you're a Gentile, and they are definitely not going to serve me." To Ross, that made sense, but in this country, restaurants don't get to choose their customers. That made up my mind. I drove with Ross over to the Vermilion Cliffs Cafe, went inside, and could almost feel a shock of surprise ripple through the place. Ross grew pale. I checked off our orders on a pad at the front counter, paid, and sat down, silently daring anyone to try and kick us out. It took a long time to cook those eggs, but the meal was eventually, although reluctantly, served. It was a small victory at the end of a very long day. Waiting for the meal had only managed to further harden a decision that I had reached earlier, while the saws had whined, and the hammers had banged, and the marshals had broken the law, and the building inspector had lied. I was going to treat Short Creek like any other town in America. Chapter 4. UEP versus Home. I was hooked. The drive home to Cedar City in the freezing dark of that winter night was almost dreamlike, and somewhere along the road I crossed the imaginary divide that separates Short Creek from the United States. The episode that I had witnessed that Saturday would not appear in the morning paper, nor on the evening news, because even if the editors heard about it, they would not deem it important enough to dispatch a reporter to cover. And for the Short Creek inhabitants like Ross, it was not really news at all. It was just another day in the creek. Happens all the time, he said. That and worse. The difference this time was that a Gentile who worked with law enforcement had been on the scene to witness it. By now, my doubts and hesitations had evaporated like mist rising from a field with the dawn. Something was very wrong down there. I reminded myself not to let emotion get ahead of professionalism. My primary concern was still to keep the Chatwins in their place. It was no longer their house, but the lower floor of a duplex, a basement apartment. But sooner or later, I understood that whatever I uncovered was going to end up in a court of law. I would dot every I and cross every T to make the case watertight. A few days later, I paid another visit to Short Creek, once again prepared to be greeted by the reception committee. Sure enough, as soon as I got into town, the plig rigs emerged out of nowhere and were on me. This time, when they closed in and started to buzz around like big mosquitoes, I let them force me to the side of the street, at which point I suddenly stopped, threw open my door, and jumped out. In my hands was a 35mm still camera with a long black lens, and I brought it up and started snapping pictures of license plates and startled faces, bounding toward them like a determined Hollywood paparazzi after a starlet. I yelled, "Hey, get out! And come on over here and talk to me!" Click, click, click. "Come on, guys, let's talk!" There was a long moment of hesitation. They had not been instructed about anything like this and just sat there, dumbfounded, in their trucks with the big engines idling as they realized the game had changed. Then they hit their gas pedals and scattered like chickens. I lowered the camera and allowed myself a chuckle as I began to realize how scared they were to be photographed. I could almost envision them speeding over to some place like the friendly Vermilion Cliffs Cafe and trying to figure out what had happened over a cup of coffee. The guy had a camera. He took our pictures. Like most bullies, they were mostly about posturing, and if you faced up to them, they didn't know how to react. My camera was scarier to them than a gun. Eventually, I grew used to their antics. After all, when you go to the circus, you expect to see clowns. I took some groceries over to Ross and Lori and their kids. They no longer had any source of income, and they were living like refugees trapped in a town that treated them as if they had the plague. No work, no money, no food. So I would try to help when I could. My dad had taught me that when you help others, you were really helping yourself. And it gave my spirits a boost to see the family hang tough while the FLDS tried to crush them. In return, the Chatwins became my guides into the tangled lore and skewed history of the FLDS. Through them, I began to meet other FLDS dissidents, the apostates, who had heard about the private investigator who was standing up to the cops and the thugs. As I developed additional sources, all paths eventually led to one person. The border towns were completely under the thumb of FLDS prophet Warren Jeffs. I listened carefully, but I wasn't there yet. I had never seen Jeffs in person. My job was to find ways to help Joan Dudley fight the eviction and to help the Chatwins keep their home. In long conversations with the Chatwins and my growing circle of apostate sources, I found an unexpected nugget of legal leverage, a precedent that had been decided less than a year earlier, in May 2003. After 3 years of litigation, the case, United Effort Trust versus Milton Holm, had ended with a half-a-loaf victory for both sides. The court ruled that the UEP did rightfully own the property, but also that Holm had made substantial improvements to it over the years and the UEP would be unjustly enriched by taking it without proper compensation for the work and money Holm had put into the 3,600-square-foot house. The FLDS refused to pay a cent, so Milton Holm was granted a life estate in the property, which meant his family could continue living there for the rest of his life. When he died, the family could be legally evicted. That was definitely something to pass along to the lawyer, Joan Dudley. It was a recent legal decision that applied to the Chatwin case. But there was more to the story than just property rights. As Ross related what had happened in his calm voice, it left me reeling in disbelief. The property title dispute faded almost to an afterthought as I was swept up in the tragic saga of the Holm family. What had happened was so unbelievable that I couldn't just take Ross's word for it. It took some time for me to piece the facts together with a lot of background work and interviews with other people. Incredibly, Ross had been right all along. It was all too true. The story involved child abuse, rape, kidnapping, extortion, smuggling minors across international borders for sexual purposes, and the astonishing fact that law enforcement agencies all the way up to the state level, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and the Royal Canadian Mounted Police had known what was going on and had looked the other way. 4 years earlier, on a warm summer morning in 2000, Lenore and Milton Holm, a couple with 13 children, were summoned to the office of Warren Jeffs for a surprise interview. That alone had set them on edge at a fear that he was going to accuse them of doing something wrong, and that they had no idea where they had strayed from being loyal. Instead, the lanky Warren informed them that they were to surrender their 15-year-old daughter, Nicole, to be a wife for Wynn Jessup, who was 23 years older, married, and had children. The wedding was already scheduled for the following day when Nicole would turn 16. The parents, who had not been alerted in advance, were taken by surprise by the instruction but were relieved that they were not being punished for some unknown transgression. They automatically agreed to the decision, just as they had been trained to do. As they went home, terrible memories flooded back to Lenore Holm of her own forced first marriage. She recalled her first wedding night to the man to whom she had been assigned before she married Milton as nothing less than a brutal assault. She couldn't bear the thought of the same thing happening to her own little girl, and by the time she and Milton arrived back home, they had changed their minds. They solemnly revoked their consent. Warren was furious. Within 10 minutes, he called up Milton and told him that he had lost priesthood for allowing his wife to run the family, that they were no longer members of the church, and that they should immediately leave their residence. Shortly afterward, the Holmes began receiving visits from more cordial church leaders, who urged them to trust the will of the prophet and yield their daughter in marriage. When they still refused, all pretense of cordiality was dropped, and the visits from FLDS leaders became threatening, promising that dire judgments of God would befall the family if they did not, illegally, place their teenage daughter into servitude. Within minutes of their final decision, the Holmes were served with an eviction notice drawn up by the FLDS's favorite lawyer, Rod Parker, of the law firm of Snow, Christensen, and Martineau in Salt Lake City, ordering them to immediately vacate their six-bedroom, three-bath house. Friends and neighbors they had known all their lives ceased speaking to them. The city turned off their utilities and their trash was no longer picked up. The community that had been their whole lives only the week before now seemed determined to crush them. But that wasn't the worst of it. Suddenly, Nicole, the pretty little daughter and targeted bride, disappeared as if she had been part of a magic show. Poof! And she was gone without a trace. A distraught Lenore pleaded with the local law, Chief Marshal Sam Roundy, to find her daughter, and he agreed to take a look. Weeks went by before Roundy reported back that he had spoken with Nicole but did not know where she was. The girl was safe, the chief said, and had voluntarily run away from home. Lenore did not believe him. She believed that her child had been kidnapped and was probably now married to Wynn Jessup. Lenore notified the Washington County Sheriff's Office in Utah, the Mojave County Sheriff's Office in Arizona, and the Attorneys General of both states. All promised to open investigations, and Nicole eventually was located in the FLDS community in Bountiful, British Columbia, Canada. Lenore knew that her daughter did not have a driver's license or a passport, so there was no legal way for her to have crossed that international border without parental permission or the appropriate documentation, particularly since she was a minor being transported for the purpose of being married against the wishes of her family. Lenore filed complaints with the Royal Canadian Mounted Police in Canada and the FBI in the United States. And once again, she was promised investigations into the disappearance of the girl. Nothing came from any of it. Nicole was indeed in Canada and had been secretly married to Wynn Jessup, to whom she had been presented like a gift. The powerful FLDS had outmaneuvered the family. Nicole, brainwashed since infancy to obey the prophet, did just that, and was convinced that her parents were wrong. She saw nothing unusual about being assigned at her young age to an older man who was already married to someone else. But since Nicole was a child in the eyes of the law, it had not been her decision to make, and if sexual relations were indeed involved, it was clearly rape, no matter what she said or wanted or believed. The church arranged it and then ran interference for her. Nicole refused to speak to her mother, stating that if any attempt was made to call or contact her, it would not be reciprocated. Expelled from the church for their actions and ordered to leave their house, the parents sued. From that came the UEP versus Holm case that had finally been settled the previous May. It was not really about property issues at all. The real crime was that Milton and Lenore had broken an unwritten FLDS law by challenging the word of the powerful prophet. Therefore, they had to be punished. The Chatwins and the Holmes provided a hint at what might lie ahead. Nicole was only 15 when church leaders tried to place her in a so-called marriage. Ross and Lori had been thinking about marrying a 16-year-old until I stopped them. There had always been chatter in the surrounding Gentile communities about young girls being married off within the FLDS, but much of it was chalked up to rebellious farm girls tiring of their restricted lives and running away from home in search of love. That happened every day somewhere in this country. But how young was too young? How low would they go within the FLDS when deciding who is ready to be married? And if little girls were involved, what about the little boys? I was just beginning to grasp the true extent of the complexities of the case. Chapter 5. Big Willie. With a court appearance looming to defend the Chatwins, we assembled a list of key FLDS players who could either be deposed or appear as witnesses. The biggest name on our list was the prophet Warren Jeffs himself, and this time, when I returned to Short Creek, I was carrying more than a camera or a hammer and nails. I had a satchel full of subpoenas. The cloistered community was shocked when I started dropping the papers on them and denting their confidence that they were exempt from such legal trifles. I began with Sam Barlow, who had been the first town marshal. Some 20 years earlier, both Utah and Arizona had decertified him as a peace officer for lying to the Washington County Sheriff about a cache of some 180 semi-automatic rifles that he had secreted in a cave. He had emerged unscathed from that decertification, and as far as the church was concerned, Barlow was a key behind-the-scenes figure when any legal trouble popped up involving the Gentile world. It was not hard to find him. A sign on the building directly across the street from the police station read, "Sam's Office." His big Chevy Suburban was parked outside, indicating he was present, so I went in. The whole building seemed to start breathing in and out as I told him I was serving him. The obese man's face reddened in outrage, as if he were about to explode. Barlow did not want to touch the subpoena, but I didn't care. He had been legally served, and he knew it, so I laid it on his desk and walked out. I served several more subpoenas over the next few days, but the one that I was most looking forward to delivering was the one bearing the name of Warren Steed Jeffs. I parked about a block away from the 10-foot-high wall that surrounded his compound and settled down to watch. The enclave, which consists of several homes, is modern and well-kept, and is in stark contrast to the poverty that surrounds it. Covering an entire city block, it looks more like a walled, gated community than the FLDS command center. Several entrances in the wall allow access, and swiveling, motorized cameras scan all visitors. The big rolling electric gates opened only for approved vehicles. About 5 o'clock, as the workday ended, traffic picked up outside the compound, and I watched a steady stream of vehicles make brief stops on the street. The driver would jump out of the car and thrust one or more envelopes into a metal mail slot built into the wall, then dash away so the next in line could make their deposits. Sources explained to me later that it happened nearly every day, as people tried to get their tithing money, donations, and letters of repentance to the prophet in a timely manner. I got out of my car and walked up to the big pedestrian gate set into the thick wall and rang the bell. Nothing. I had counted more than 20 other cameras around the compound, with additional tiny cameras the size of lipstick cases covering specific areas like porches and under the eaves of the buildings. One big motorized camera had been placed right over the west entrance. I buzzed the intercom and heard the hum of the camera moving to focus its big eye on me. A young female voice from the intercom asked if she could help me. I said I had some documents for Warren Jeffs. She went silent, so I waited a few minutes and buzzed again. The same voice asked the same question. I repeated my answer. She replied that he wasn't there. I kept talking, trying to coax her into sending someone out to talk to me in person. In Utah, it is legal to serve a subpoena on any occupant over the age of 14 at the address in question. The receptionist, however, just said, "Thank you," then cut me off. After that, she would not even answer the intercom. I smiled up at the camera, then left, going on to my next stop. At the time, the Jeffs compound was one of the only places in town with such tight security. But that quickly changed after my first subpoena blitz. Within 2 weeks, new fences with security cameras and no trespassing signs began to appear everywhere. Before, I had been able to drive directly up to the health clinic and park in a space reserved for the Bishop of Short Creek, Uncle Fred Jessup, when I tried to serve a subpoena on him. Now, the clinic was completely surrounded with a reinforced vinyl security fence and a guard shack perched at the newly installed gates. On an early March morning in 2004, a 15-passenger white van wheeled up to the courthouse in Kingman, Arizona, the Mojave County seat. The doors opened, and out spilled a small army of FLDS church leaders who would represent the church's attempt to evict Ross Chatwin. Only three or four of them had been called as witnesses, some of whom I recognized because I had dropped subpoenas on them. So the others had shown up either for moral support or, more likely, to make certain everybody else said and did the right things. They were cocky. They were arrogant and disrespectful. They were the FLDS on a mission from the prophet. Joan Dudley was unimpressed by this gang, and she hardly looked up from her papers as they bumbled into the courtroom, bringing along their own security team of church goons. They took seats in the row in front of me, talking loudly, and that gave me a chance to both look them over and listen to their comments. Occasionally, to gauge their response and learn more about them, I would make a calculated comment to someone nearby. Judging from the sharp looks thrown my way, the tactic apparently worked. Soon, the goons were up and quietly badgering the court bailiffs to find out who I was. The combativeness of the day came to a head when Dudley called Willie Jessup to the stand. I had heard a lot about this guy and was eager to see if the rumors were true. Jessup was a longtime FLDS bully who had wormed himself into a useful position with some of the church leaders, who felt that his bulk and willingness to do as he was told could work to their advantage. His role was always an unofficial one that the leaders could deny if necessary. It was Willie who later shoved a camera at me as I left my doctor's office before open-heart surgery. He had a flair for the theatrical, and when his name was called, he swaggered to the witness chair to face the detested black woman lawyer. She worked him over for a while, and he dodged the questions, stalled, and gave evasive answers, trying to insinuate that he, not she, was in control. Joan tuned him up like she was winding a clock. "Are you a bodyguard for the church?" she asked, raising her eyebrows slightly. He responded that it depended on what she meant by the word bodyguard. She asked if he was a bodyguard for Fred Jessup, the Uncle Fred, who held the rank of second counselor to Warren Jeffs and was the bishop of the town. Uncle Fred had mysteriously vanished, and I had been unable to subpoena him at the health clinic. She received the same non-answer from Willie. For the third time, Dudley tried the same question, and Willie admitted that on occasion he sometimes accompanied Uncle Fred. "Were you a bodyguard for Rulon Jeffs, the former prophet?" Willie belatedly recognized that this line of questioning was painting him to be a long-time church enforcer. He dodged. She followed. "Are you Warren Jeff's bodyguard?" Willie fell back to saying that depended on the definition of the word bodyguard. But Joan had laid the groundwork, and she sprung the trap. "Want a definition of bodyguard? Okay." She wagged a finger at him, as if she were a schoolteacher with a particularly dense child, and barked, "Do you guard Warren Jeff's body?" He refused to respond, so she asked Judge James Chavez to order him to do so. Once more, Willie began a wavering ramble about the proper definition, and Joan pounced. "Do you guard Warren Jeff's body?" He still would not answer directly, so the judge ordered him to do so, and Willie arrogantly replied, "No comment." Judge Chavez exploded. "Who do you think you are? You're not outside talking to the media." He reminded Willie that he was under oath in a court of law and that he would definitely answer the question or suffer the consequences. I watched with great satisfaction as the top FLDS enforcer was forced to give in to a black woman and a Hispanic judge. Getting Willie Jessup to admit in court to having been the bodyguard for the most important men in the hierarchy would prove to be a valuable tool that would be used against him in the coming years. When the hearing was finished, the FLDS had failed in its effort to evict Ross Chatwin and his family. It was a good day in court, and it took Ross a step closer to obtaining a life estate of his own. Up to that point, I had never even met Willie, but his name was always popping up because the apostates of Short Creek seemed to be scared of him, and also of his smaller half-brother, Dee. The two men are muscle for the church and are not shy about yearning to be God's avengers. They live for the day they are called upon to protect the prophet and priesthood. Willie is a large man, about 6'5", and weighing probably around 300 pounds, with brown hair that he sweeps back Elvis style. A man named Richard Jessup Ream, who would become one of my clients in another case, later provided me with a deeper look into Willie's disturbed psyche. In an affidavit, Ream described the time that he and some friends were chatting with some local girls at the post office in Short Creek, unconcerned by the fact that the girls were considered off-limits by the church leadership. Big Willie drove up and glowered. "Leave the priesthood girls alone," he snapped. When Ream replied that he would talk with whomever he chose, Willie closed the conversation with a threat, "If I have to use guns to straighten you little bastards out, I'm going to do just that, and Uncle Warren is going to back me up." Ream took that seriously. He had visited Jessup's home on Westfield Avenue in Hilldale and knew the man owned the hardware to make good on his threat. Ream described the place as a mini-fortress, with all the windows blacked out because Willie was convinced that law enforcement had him under surveillance and that government intrusion was imminent. The basement reeked of gun oil and shelves sagged along two walls beneath the weight of cases of ammunition, reloading equipment, and gun supplies. The other two walls and some tables were laden with assault weapons, pistols, rifles and shotguns, including a huge Barrett 50-caliber sniper rifle, which can kill up to a mile away, and nearly every kind of small arms weapon imaginable. Ream's affidavit stated, "I asked Mr. Jessup if it concerned him that he was in possession of illegal assault rifles. At the time, those were banned." Willie laughed and replied that what the law didn't know wouldn't hurt them. He was ready to use deadly force if the prophet commanded it. As if not to be outdone, Willie's brother, D. Jessup, has openly stated that he would willingly cut the throats of his wives if the prophet gave the order. I have no doubt that both are serious. Together, they have a tendency to more than double the trouble, becoming exponentially meaner. They are formidable and unpredictable. I have heard Willie brag to his admirers within my earshot about almost having had to take me down. The fact is that Willie rarely comes closer than 20 feet of me, and, aside from our recent encounter in the parking lot of my doctor's office, we have never had anything resembling a real conversation, but not for my lack of trying. He is invariably parked, lurking somewhere nearby, when trouble arises within the FLDS, or if I have some business in the crick. When I attempt to communicate with him, I get no response. He drives a high-dollar Mercedes-Benz SUV that is decked out with the latest police radios and scanners, and even a satellite dish on the roof. I have tried walking up and tapping on the window of his vehicle and motioning for him to step outside and talk. He responds by locking all the doors and staring straight ahead. One of the more interesting aspects of my entire investigation has been watching Big Willie evolve from being just a convenient thug for Warren Jeffs to becoming an affluent businessman and the slick spokesman for the entire FLDS religion. He is always welcome on national television shows, where he is acknowledged as the face of the cult. He is among the best I have seen at being able to lie like a thief and get away with it. His rise to power says a lot about how the FLDS operates by instilling fear. I always make sure my guard is up when Big Willie is around. While working my way through college, one of my many jobs was training police dogs. Willie reminded me of what we called in that business a fear biter. When you are not looking, such an animal sneaks up from behind, yaps a few times, nips at your heels, and then slinks away. It just is not prudent to show your back to a fear biter like Willie. I consider both Willie and his brother Dee to be very dangerous men. Chapter 6 P.I. The work in Short Creek brought up some personal and professional considerations for me. The private detective business is just that, a business, and I had to earn a living. I could not just drop everything and my paying clients elsewhere to constantly run down to that crazy town. I could only work for so long on a dollar. But likewise, I also could not, would not, give up on my investigation. I had stumbled into an unbelievable place and an entire culture that should not exist in this country, and many of the people I was meeting were fighting for their very survival. My research and paperwork files were stacking higher with each visit. Progress had been made to get a safe haven for the Chatwins, and it was time for me to take a breather. But I knew that I wasn't finished with the FLDS. I seemed uniquely qualified to investigate the group. Not only was I a well-educated and trained professional in the law enforcement field, but there was something else just as important in this matter. I was a Mormon. I knew my religion, its traditions, its history, and its texts well. So I could cut through the blather of the FLDS when they tried to wrap their criminal activity with a sacred cloth of piety. Add to that the interesting fact that my great-grandfather served prison time in the late 19th century for being a polygamist. My grandmother was the youngest daughter of his youngest wife. When I had heard those stories as a kid, they seemed as outdated as other quirky tales from back in the age of the covered wagon. Now it seemed that I should have paid a little more attention to my mother's family history. My mom had made sure that her four raucous sons regularly attended church, and at the age of 16 I was ordained to the position of a priest in the Mormon church in the small Southern California town of Banning, a place that was so quiet and normal that it was like Leave It to Beaverville. As a priest, I was able to participate in the duty of blessing the sacrament, something that I took very seriously. Then one Sunday as I knelt to say the prayer, a woman in the congregation hurried up to our bishop and whispered something. He abruptly stopped the service and announced that a matter needed to be addressed. I was led away from the sacrament table, and everyone in the church stared as if I were some kind of freak during that long trip up the aisle. I had no idea what was happening. I thought my dad had been in an accident or something equally as horrible. In his office, the bishop said he had just been informed that I had been seen being arrested in front of the church on the previous Wednesday night. She is sure it was you, and that a highway patrolman took you away in handcuffs, he said. If that is the case, then I can't allow you to bless the sacrament. You have to be worthy, so we'll need to get someone to take your place. I was embarrassed and angry as I explained that the patrolman was Darrell Crossman, the leader of my Explorer Scout troop, and that he had offered me a ride in his cruiser. The bishop should not have interrupted the church meeting to confront me, but he had bought into the busybody's accusation. Now he apologized. Come on, we'll take you back up on the stand and everyone will see that you haven't done anything wrong, he said. As I walked with him back toward the altar, My mind was churning with emotion. I could not continue as if nothing had happened. Why would I want to have anything to do with a church that would humiliate me? I walked out, and I did not set foot in another Mormon church for 26 years. I grew up as a Southern California kid bent on enjoying life. My dad told me that everything I wanted to know had been written down in a book somewhere, awakening my curiosity and probably giving me a bit of an edge growing up during a very tumultuous period. During the summer when I was 8, I read Homer's Iliad and the Odyssey, plowed through the library's shelves of biography, autobiography, and history, and then turned to the 32 volumes of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Still, I was swept up in the counterculture madness that was California in the 1960s, and I tumbled from gifted pupil to troubled youth. Out of school, out of church, and out of luck at 18 years old, I drifted from coast to coast, always looking for the next party as I earned a living in the building trades. My motorcycle was my best friend. It had a special sheath in which I kept a pair of crutches, which I needed from having been in so many accidents. But the worst mishap came in 1979 when I was a passenger in a pickup truck that slammed into a huge rock on a mountain road. The collision broke my neck and jaw, and a lot of other bones, leaving me in a body cast with steel plates in my head and face holding me together and a future of reconstructive surgeries. The doctors expected me to die. I spent several weeks in traction while undergoing multiple reconstructive surgeries and 5 months in a halo, a medieval-looking metal band that encircled my head, with bolts tightened into my skull with a torque wrench to keep my head immobile. My neck was broken at the C2 vertebra, an injury commonly referred to as a hangman's break. The purpose of the halo was to make it possible for me to move around, instead of being immobilized in a special bed that kept me in traction. The problem was, I had been in bed so long that my muscles atrophied to the point of uselessness, and I had to learn to walk all over again. It took 2 long years to finally get my legs back under me and start feeling whole again. That close call allowed me to believe I had been given a second chance with life, a rare opportunity to start anew, and I decided to change course. I started to really grow up, got married, and settled down to start a family. But when our kids were born, my wife and I began to realize that Southern California probably wasn't the best place to raise them. For a variety of reasons, none of them having to do with religion, we decided to move to Utah. I still had no religious affiliation, and my wife knew little about Mormons. But when my partner in a construction business in Riverside, California, learned of our decision to relocate to Utah, he was bewildered and concerned. "Be careful," he warned. "The place is full of polygamists." "Well, we have Crips and Bloods out here, Gene," I said. "The cops just found the body of an 8-year-old girl who had been brutalized and tossed alongside the freeway just a few blocks from my home, and you think I should be afraid of a few polygamists?" I was sick of hearing remarks about polygamists and Utah. Polygamy hadn't been practiced for more than 100 years out there, or so I thought. So we headed for Cedar City, a place that now seems to have been picked for us by fate. When we pulled up to our new house, people we had never seen before came over to help us unload, bringing food and instant friendship. There were Mormons and non-Mormons alike. One introduced himself as Brig Young. My wife, holding a plate of cookies that had just been brought over, blurted out, "Oh, come on." Brig chuckled and said, "Yep, it's true. The firstborn son is always named Brigham. It's a family tradition." He was a direct descendant. After leading cautious lives in what had turned into a high-crime area of Southern California, we were pleased to be among friendly neighbors. 6 years after our move, I graduated from Southern Utah University with a 3.87 grade point average and a degree in criminal justice with an emphasis in criminalistics and a minor in chemistry.
It had taken a long time for me to get through college while working full-time and raising a family, but I never give up. Then I got down to business. Right after college, I teamed up with a friend who was a private investigator in Cedar City. The town's growth had inevitably been accompanied by an increase in crime and drugs, and I saw an opportunity in the bail bond industry, which would, I hoped, provide some additional income. Along with that, I also became a bounty hunter, legally tracking down people who had had some sort of brush with the law and returning them to the custody of the sheriff to await a court appearance. My state license as a bounty hunter proved to be a potent tool. In most states, bounty hunters do not even need permission or probable cause to enter a dwelling unannounced to make an arrest. And through reciprocity agreements, if a case originates in Utah, I could follow it across state lines and go into other cities with the same authority I had at home. I became good at finding people who didn't want to be found. I learned a lot about tenacity and seeing a difficult assignment through. Among my first jobs was a self-assigned cold case project back in California. Even before we moved to Utah, Larry Wheelock, one of my best buddies, had been murdered in a home invasion robbery, and the killer had never been caught. I dug out the files, pestered detectives, and discovered some new evidence by using new technologies. Within 6 months, Larry Donald Page was arrested for the murder. At 26 years, it had been the oldest cold case to be solved in Orange County history. Because an adversarial situation plays out in just about every case, I have made a decision to be armed most of the time. I have come to the realization that it would be foolhardy to find myself, or worse, my family, in circumstances that might require having to protect ourselves against the threat of serious injury or death, and not have the means to do so. I refuse to let that happen. As I settled more into our new home and life, I began to feel an obligation to my children, and myself, to contemplate the value of some sort of spiritual life. After years of exploring many religions, I was converted, along with my family, to the mainstream LDS church. I had returned to my Mormon roots. By the time I drove down to Short Creek to meet Ross Chatwin for the first time in 2004, I already had a lifetime of experience dealing with hard cases. Little did I know that I was on a collision course with Prophet Warren Jeffs and the breakaway, mysterious sect called the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Chapter 7. The Father. I vividly remember my grandfather's stories of leaving his home in Farmington, Utah, and riding the rails to San Bernardino, California, in his search for work during the Great Depression. Wall Street had crashed, thousands of banks had closed, and wiped out the savings of millions of people. Industrial production collapsed, and farmers throughout America lost their land. Utah's citizens were trying to survive, but times were hard in this rugged state. There was a great exodus of men looking for work. However, returning to Utah from England about that time was a tall, neatly dressed, 23-year-old man with a nice smile and dark hair who had escaped the ruination that had been suffered by so many. His name was Rulon Timpson Jeffs. He arrived not in a boxcar, but on a passenger train, and he was a loyal, practicing member of the mainstream Mormon church. Born in 1909 in Salt Lake City, Jeffs, a highly intelligent young man, became valedictorian of his LDS high school class in 1928 and delivered the graduation address in the Mormon Tabernacle in Salt Lake City, which he recalled as a knee-knocking experience. Mormon young men are encouraged to undertake a proselytizing mission for the church as they mature from adolescence to manhood. It requires that they set aside their own wants and needs and devote 2 years of their lives to spreading their beliefs through personal example. Brigham Young once said those called to the position must have clean hands and pure hearts, and be pure from the crown of your head to the soles of your feet. Then, live so every hour. LDS missionaries continue to be an extraordinarily successful means of spreading the Mormon message around the world, and multitudes of people have responded to the words and deeds of the devoted young saints. Rulon Jeffs began his own mission on June 1, 1930. He was sent to London, where he became a secretary at the mission headquarters. 2 years later, he was home again and was given a secure job with the Utah State Tax Commission, a salaried government position that included an office in the Capitol building in Salt Lake City. In June 1934, his fortunes grew even more when he married Grace Zola Brown, the daughter of influential LDS apostle Hugh B. Brown. That gave the ambitious Rulon a direct link to leadership and influence. He and Zola had two children. As I plunged into the daunting task of figuring out the structure and history of the FLDS and its leadership, it was apparent that understanding the enigmatic prophet Rulon Jeffs would be necessary before there could be any hope of grasping the madness of his son, Prophet Warren Jeffs. Was Warren an extension of his father's eccentricities and deviant behavior? Between them, the two men hijacked the fundamentalist movement, established a position of unchecked power, and sowed chaos and perversion in their wake for 50 years. The Mormons' incredible record-keeping system would prove to be invaluable as I assembled the puzzle. The genealogy and family histories of millions of individuals, soon to be billions as more databases come online, are available through LDS resources. I have even found and read my polygamous great-grandfather's personal diary, digitized and available online in its original form. Starting the investigation, I began to amass material gleaned from legal documents, the churning of online search engines, books and papers available in libraries and private collections, private law enforcement databases, public business transactions, and information from personal interviews and conversations. This is the kind of project that I find particularly intriguing as an investigator. I love this stuff. The problem was that the fundamentalists were no less enthusiastic about their own records. They were intensely paranoid about their illegal lifestyle and did a thorough job of hiding their accounts. For a researcher, that created an occasional black hole. I felt the information must be out there somewhere, beyond my reach, secreted away in barns or cubbyholes, behind false walls or in locked rooms. I would fantasize that at some future place and time, I would find my way to that hidden trove of information, or it would find its way to me. The hallelujah moment for Rulon Jeffs, his introduction to Mormon fundamentalism, came on September 25, 1938, when he took his father, David Ward Jeffs, out for a birthday dinner. David had been a closet polygamist for years, so deep underground that Rulon had been born in hiding to David's second wife. The boy lived for the first 10 years of his life under the fake name of Rulon Jennings, although in such a society, it is doubtful he ever questioned his name change. The practice was not uncommon in other families that he knew, and that was just how things were. David allowed his son to become a faithful mainstream Mormon, perhaps because being discovered as a polygamist could have meant a jail term for the father. Now, at his father's birthday dinner, it was time for Rulon to know everything, and David presented his son with a copy of The Truth magazine, an underground publication put out for those maintaining the covert and illegal practice of plural marriage. In his memoirs, Rulon wrote, "I asked Father, 'What is this?' He told me it was put out by Joseph W. Musser. I said, 'By what authority?' So he told me, and he took me to see Brother Musser, who received me like a father into the work, and I got well acquainted with him. When I was told about the priesthood council, I said,
"Father, who is the head man?" And the reply was, "Well, he has to be in kind of hiding." I said, "I want to see him." So I finally got to see Uncle John over on 809 East, 700 South. Met him in his home there. My heart leaped for joy finding the prophet. Uncle John was John Y. Barlow, the acknowledged leader of the secret movement, who had been excommunicated by the LDS Church. After those meetings, Rulon Jeffs fully embraced the fundamentalist philosophy, casually discarding the religious faith he had practiced his entire life. After joining the flock, he hung out with his new friends at cottage meetings around Salt Lake City, where they spoke fervently about the plural lifestyle and how to mold this idealistic priesthood order to oversee the breakaway faith, which was called the Work by its adherents. Priesthood may best be described as the spiritual glue that binds together the FLDS power structure. Usually, when a boy is about 12 years old, he is ordained within the fundamentalist religion into a preparatory level called the Aaronic Priesthood. It is a means of taking on responsibility and commitment, and is not too different from similar practices under other names with the youth in other churches. Any comparison ends there. Elsewhere, priesthood is about service. In the FLDS, it is about power and control. And even the Aaronic priesthood would be swept into that black vortex. The higher up the ecclesiastical ladder a man climbed, the more priesthood powers he enjoyed. In the hands of Prophet Warren Jeffs, priesthood was wielded like a magic wand. It meant whatever Jeffs wanted it to mean, and he used it as a handy camouflage and justification for his dreadful actions. To lose priesthood was to lose everything. When Rulon told Zola in 1940 that he had found a shop girl that he wanted to marry as an additional wife, she balked. Polygamy was no longer part of Mormon doctrine, and anyone found practicing it would be excommunicated. This simply had not been part of the deal when they got married. For Zola, as with the vast majority of Mormons, polygamy was a thing of the past. Her father, the LDS apostle Hugh B. Brown, came to the house and issued an ultimatum for Rulon to either give up his heretical ideas or be kicked out of both the LDS church and the Brown family. Having already surreptitiously taken his new bride, Rulon refused, and both threats came to pass. The divorced Zola took their sons and moved to California. Her departure did not really bother Rulon. In the coming years, he replaced her with a harem of dozens of wives. Polygamy had been illegal for more than 60 years by the time Rulon decided it would be his life's calling. Back in January 1879, the United States Supreme Court had heard the case of George Reynolds, a Mormon resident in the Utah Territory who was charged with having two wives, Amelia Jane Schofield, and Mary Ann Tuddenham. In a unanimous decision, the High Court found Reynolds guilty of violating the Morrill Anti-Bigamy Act. The Reynolds case set the stage for the Mormon Church to discontinue the practice of polygamy and for Utah to become a state. Wilford Woodruff, the fourth LDS prophet, issued what became known as the 1890 Manifesto, which made monogamy official church doctrine. Special provisions were eventually made into law allowing those who were already in plural marriages at the time to continue them without disruption. But no new plural marriages could be performed. That was the situation under which my pioneer great-grandfather lived, although he was occasionally hassled by the authorities for cohabitation or living with a woman to whom he was not legally married. He paid $150 on one cohabitation charge and noted that it was a lot of money. Eventually, polygamy faded from the mainstream church as most Mormons busily assimilated into the growing United States. However, the deep divide had been created with the manifesto. A handful of die-hard polygamists refused to go along with the new direction, arguing that the church had abandoned God's will, and that a man must possess numerous wives. The dissidents were excommunicated and driven into secrecy. By splitting away,
the fundamentalists found themselves shorn of the right to set foot in any LDS temple, and temples are extremely important to Mormons, who use them as places for special worship, such as formal marriages in which everlasting vows are taken. The rebels could reasonably substitute meetings in private homes for their normal church services, but they had nothing that resembled a temple, and this created a big hole to fill in their new brand of religion. They came up with the novel excuse that since they were the true